Thank you, Cheryl. And just so you know, anytime I always start by just inviting questions. So if that doesn't make it on the recording, that's probably fine, since it'd be hard to ask the recording a question. So take your time getting the recording going. And with that said, I will invite again, as I always do, your questions. You can post them here as a comment on the comment board, or you can raise your hand. And if I'm not noticing, do both, and maybe I'll see you sooner. And you can interrupt me at any time if something I'm saying evokes a question, or if you just suddenly think of something that you'd like to have addressed. I'll try and get to it, and if I don't get to it in this satsang, I'll save it for the following satsang. And then, as I always also mention, you can also email me during the week at nirmala@endless-satsang.com, and I'll look over your question and give a response when I next time we come together like this for satsang. So I don't see any questions yet. Don't, like I say, don't hesitate. Even if I start talking about something else, just jump right in. But if there are no questions to start with, I will pick up again with the exploration of the practice and purpose of self-inquiry, which I started speaking about 2 weeks ago. And so that was part one, and this talk is taken from an article that you can read along on my website. If sometimes, some people are more visual, some people are more auditory, but if you like to have a visual reference when someone's talking, sort of like cliff notes, because I will depart from the actual written text when something comes to say that's not in the written part. But it's an article that's also in my book, Everything Is Included. But I will post this is I can't post the entire link because it doesn't allow me to post links, but I just put up on the board the suffix of the URL. So it would be HTTP, all that, endless-satsang.com/the-practice-and-purpose-of-self-inquiry.htm. So the practice and purpose of self-inquiry.htm with dashes between all the words. You can also just go on endless-satsang.com and do a search for self-inquiry, and it would probably come up in the search results right near the top. So last time I covered or spoke about the two main forms. I spoke a little bit about how all spiritual practices either are a fit or are not a fit. And so that still applies if you play with self-inquiry and find that it is a fit, that's wonderful. If you play with it and it doesn't seem to have much resonance or much effect, then it's probably best to just move on to another practice. But the two main forms, they're kind of like looping questions, repeating questions that are used in very, very specifically in the practice of self-inquiry, in this kind of inward questioning of who am I. And that's the first question, who am I or what am I? And so I spoke a little bit about that and the different forms of that question, but also a follow-up whenever you kind of get distracted is to, when you start to be focusing on a thought or a feeling or something, in your environment catches your attention, and you just notice that you're having that experience, and then you can ask, to whom is this thought, sensation, or experience happening? And the obvious answer to that question is it's happening to me. It's happening to my I to me. And so once, in a sense, that brings you back to that sense of I. And then then you repeat the first question, who am I or what am I? What is this I that is experiencing the thought or experiencing the sensation? And so that, I'd like to say that that really captures the essence of the inward self-inquiry, is this redirecting attention to the sense of self, to the sense of I. Sometimes it even works best without a question, just a practice, just an intention to keep bringing your attention back to the sense of I. And it doesn't have to be a mystical or expanded or cosmic sense of I. It can be an ordinary sense of I. It's whatever sense of yourself, of your individuality or your being that is present right now. It's the thing that you're referring to when someone in a crowded room says, is your name John or is Sally here? And you kind of raise your hand and say, yeah, I'm here. What are you referring to? I am here. What is that I? What is that sense of being here? And so anything that directs your attention back to that, if you just stay with that sense of I, when your attention wanders, notice who is having the experience of whatever your attention wanders onto, and then come back to that sense of I. And it can open up into a very rich, surprisingly rich exploration in spite of the simplicity of the practice. In fact, that's often what people stumble on, is the simplicity of this practice. And another looping, a way to loop the question, because sometimes, you know, our mind jumps in with an answer. And so you say, who or what am I? And the mind, of course, has an answer. It says, I am this body, or I am a man, or I am pure awareness, or I am, a plumber, I am a doctor, I am the thinker of my thoughts. You know, there's just something that pops in, and it seems like a definitive answer or a specific answer. And that's great. You can experience how the sense of I am, the sense of your being or self, is somehow associated with whatever followed the words I am in your answer. I am a man. You can experience that there's a truth in it, or I am a woman. There's an experiential quality to that aspect of your being. And so you can allow that answer to come, and then the follow-up question, the question that creates a kind of loop for it, is to ask, if I am even more than that, what am I? Or who am I? And so it just opens the door to there being more of an answer. And so if you say, I am a man, the follow-up question would be, and if you are more than a man, what are you? And even when you get to some very expanded answers, some very all-inclusive answers, I am awareness, I am pure consciousness, I am infinite space, it's still interesting to follow that assertion, that statement, with the question, and if you are more than that, if you are more than pure awareness, if you are more than infinite space, what are you? So those were the two main forms that I spoke about last time. And I just mentioned, I started to talk about how those questions can actually take you to all these different levels of your being. I mean, clearly there are, you know, very specific physical levels, like I am the body or I am a man, or there are very relative aspects of your, like, functioning, where you say I am a plumber or I am a doctor. And then very quickly it can move into more subtle, deeper layers of your existence, of yourself. And that can be anything from sort of essential qualities. I think of essence as the functional aspect of our true nature. And so it's the aspect of our deeper true nature, our ultimately mysterious, undefinable nature beyond even awareness. It's aspects of that that function in the world. And so it's things like love and compassion and strength and clarity and peace and joy. And these are the aspects of our true nature that sort of rise to the surface, come to the fore when they're appropriate, when the circumstances, when the moment itself kind of calls them forth. And then sometimes the questioning can take you right beyond even those kind of relative or specific qualities of experience to, again, the undefinable, empty, mysterious space of being itself, of the oneness of all being. And at that point, you know, words sometimes fail, but it's still a wonderful practice when you get in touch with something beyond even form, beyond specific experience, to just stay focusing your attention on that undefinable sense of self, and that undefinable sense of an I. There still can be a sense of something existing or nothing existing, nothing being present. It may not, again, be anything you can put into words, but you can keep bringing your attention back to it. It's kind of a simple little taste of that you can explore right here, right now, is just to notice the space behind your eyes. How there is a strange kind of place where seeing stops because your eyes, you know, you don't have eyes on the back of your head. And so there's this, a certain field of vision, you know, our peripheral vision, what's in front of us. And then at a certain point, it's kind of like that ends. And there's this, it's empty even of emptiness. It's like not even, you can maybe intuit or feel a sense of space behind your eyes. But it really ultimately doesn't have any qualities. And so you can, again, if these questions help direct your attention to something subtle like that, then even the question, what is the space behind my eyes, can help keep the focus of attention on that mysterious space behind your eyes that is seeing the room. Possibly seeing the computer screen if your eyes are open, or even if your eyes are closed, then you're seeing the inside of your eyelids. So the question is still arises, what is behind your eyes? Now, the next section, if you're following along with the article on the website, the next section is entitled Maps of Reality and the Purpose of Inquiry. And this kind of just follows up on what we were just speaking about, that the practice of inquiry can put you in touch with a lot of different levels of your being, different levels of reality, different levels of what's here. And what ultimately you're referring to when someone says your name and you raise your hand and say, I am here. I am. What is that? And I start off by saying that the examples I'm using imply a certain map of reality and of the truth of our nature. There are many such maps, including highly detailed and complex maps, such as the map provided by the Diamond Approach, as developed by Hamid Ali, also known as A.H. Almas. That's his pen name, A.H. Almas. Students of the Diamond Approach spend years exploring the many qualities of essence and different dimensions of being that have been mapped out in the body of knowledge about true nature within that particular school or teaching. It's a wonderfully rich and complex map. And in contrast, there are very simple maps, such as the ones offered by some of the more purist Advaita or non-dual teachings. In some of those maps, there are only two locations. The first location is all appearances and experiences, which are seen as illusory and unimportant. And then the second location is the ultimate reality of one pure consciousness in which everything else appears and disappears. In the really purest Advaita non-dual perspective, that even that is a, you know, the idea of consciousness or the idea of a oneness. Both of those are seen as still somewhat illusory. So that's a very simple map. It'd be like, you know, a map of a two-room house. There's the room with all the furniture and all the people and all the, you know, the kitchen and all that stuff. And then there's this other room that's like empty, and even empty of walls and ceilings and floors. You step into that room and there's no boundaries and there's no experiencer, there's nothing. And that this kind of map, the simple two-room map, can be helpful at times in cutting through all of the layers to go directly to the deepest reality. However, it can also be limiting if in the practice of inquiry, in the actual asking of this question, in the actual directing attention to yourself, if that inquiry lands you somewhere in one of the more relative levels, if it lands you in a sense of essence or in a sense of even a sense of pure awareness, but there's still something definable, there's something experiential to where you land. And you have this two-room map, and you're somehow like you're discovering all these rooms between the room with all the stuff in it and the empty room. And it's like, this simple map, it seems to be missing something here in the middle. In fact, one teacher I know calls it the middle kingdom. It's almost like something from Tolkien or something. He refers to all those rooms in the middle as the middle kingdom. And so if inquiry lands you in one of the more relative levels and yet more subtle relative levels, there, if you have a two-room map, there can be sort of a rejection of or a denial of the more subtle truths, the more even of the more relative truths. There are no wrong answers in inquiry, so it can be helpful to have a more complete map at times when you arrive in some new, unfamiliar dimension of your being that nonetheless is a powerful and liberating experience, even if it's not the ultimate truth. So I love kind of systems of thought, maps of reality. I love exploring all that stuff. I love finding parallels between them. And so I'm just by nature more drawn to the more complex maps. But I think it's also maybe helpful at this point to interject that even when you have a very complete map, everyone's journey is unique. So even in this practice of inquiry, there's no formula for where the next round of questions or the next moment's simple directing of attention to the sense of self, where within the many levels, the many layers of reality you will land. So you can, I like the metaphor, it's imagine if everyone listening right now had a map of the world in front of them, and they had a magic marker and they drew in that map everywhere they, you know, their life's journey, starting at, you know, putting the pen down on the spot on the world map of the world where they were born, and then traced everywhere they traveled as they proceeded through life. And some people's, you know, little squiggle would be, you know, relatively small. Maybe they never left the country they were born in. Other people's drawing on the map would have this, you know, would have these huge journeys across the oceans and here and there and back and forth and up and down, east and west, north and south. But everyone's journey would be unique. Everyone's experience of that world, of the physical world as represented by the map, as they drew it out, would be unique. And that is really a good metaphor for the spiritual journey. I often point out that this mystery, this ultimate mystery of being, of oneness, of true nature, does not even create a snowflake the same way twice. And so it makes perfect sense that it would not create the experience of a human incarnation, or a series of human incarnations, and even a human incarnation that leads to spiritual awakening, spiritual realization. It would never do it the same way twice. If we compared all the maps of everybody in the world where they drew their journey on the surface of the planet, no two maps would be identical. They would all have their unique little twists and turns. And that's true in the spiritual journey in general, and also it's true in this practice, or as I mentioned last time, that this play, this game of self-inquiry. This raises the question of what is the purpose of inquiry. In some traditions, the sole purpose of inquiry is to take someone to the deepest realization of no self or emptiness or ultimate true nature that is possible. And again, this is where that two-room map, the simple and pure Advaita or non-dual perspective, the only point is to get to that emptiness, that spaciousness, that unchanging underlying reality. And in other traditions, the purpose of inquiry is to become familiar with and explore all of the different dimensions of reality, including the deepest reality. So this is more a purpose of covering the map with as many, drawing as including as many countries, as many experiences, as many dimensions in the case of our true nature as possible. It's really a three-dimensional, or actually many more dimensional map that we're drawing on when we travel through our true nature. In the broader view of the journey of inquiry, the ultimate is not any particular experience or non-experience. The ultimate is complete and total flexibility to experience and even function within all of reality's many expressions. Again, this flexibility is only complete if it includes the deepest realizations of emptiness and beyond. But it would seem that a complete perspective would not create a new, more subtle duality between true nature, including, and the many levels of existence, including ordinary everyday identity as a particular individual. That's again one of the problems with that simple two-room or two-reality map, is that it creates a kind of duality. It can create a sense of separation and a possibility of denial of or rejection of relative reality and all these other subtle dimensions of reality. Everything and every possible experience is part of the totality of existence and is therefore a potential discovery as a result of inquiry. Perhaps, just as there are no wrong answers to the inquiry questions themselves, there is no right or wrong overall purpose to inquiry. Whatever results you pursue or simply stumble upon in doing inquiry are there to be discovered. It's like there is no wrong path to take on your journey on the surface of the earth. There's no like right sequence of countries to visit. There's no wrong sequence of countries to visit, or cities to visit, or places to go. And so in doing this inquiry, you can have a kind of open-ended purpose. Whatever results you pursue or stumble upon in doing inquiry are there to be discovered. And since nothing is ever finished within eternity, how could it be? Otherwise it wouldn't be eternity. Who knows where life and inquiry and awareness will take you next? You may just never be done exploring this, not just the map. I mean, the maps are just a tool to actually explore the reality. And that at some points it's nice to travel without a map and just be curious about where you land. So now the next section is called practical pointers, and they're just kind of helpful pointers, practical things. And by the way, there's quite a bit of repetition when I speak about this, but that actually kind of fits with inquiry, because inquiry, again, ultimately inquiry can be very, very simple. It can be done even without a question. It can just be this redirecting your attention back to the sense of I. And whatever arises, whatever happens, you stay in touch with that sense of I. And there's no right or wrong answers to the questions in inquiry. There's also no right or wrong sense of I. So if in that moment it's a very physical sense of I, it's a very body-centered, body-oriented sense of I, if in that moment it's a very mental sense of I, if you know someone said, "Where are you right now?" you'd say, "I'm lost in thought." And yet, there's that sense of I. Another word for it is identity. There is a sense of your identity as the one having the thoughts. And so you can, whatever the experience is, you can keep bringing your attention back to that sense of I. If you're lost in thought, the sense of I will probably be very small. Because it itself is probably a thought. You've identified with your thoughts, and so whoever you are is who you think you are in that moment. And that's okay. That's fascinating that our identity can do that. I think it was in the Carlos Castaneda books that Don Juan talked about, he called it the assemblage point. And that's a wonderful kind of description of our sense of identity. It's where we kind of assemble our I. And we can assemble our I out of thoughts. We can assemble our I out of feelings. We can assemble our I out of the physicality of our body. And we can assemble our I. We can have our identity move into these subtler dimensions. And we can even have our sense of identity move into the kind of ultimate reality beyond specific experiences, into awareness itself. It's a strange thing to call it an assemblage point, because those much, much larger dimensions, there's not a lot of assembling because you're including the space in which everything else is located. So it's kind of like, you know, assembling a city that's already there. You know, no assembly required. You are identified as the entire planet right now. Again, no assembly required. It's at those levels, at those bigger levels, there's not so much a sense of assemblage. In fact, there can be a sense of being disassembled. Have your sense of identity get so big that it kind of disassembles the ordinary forms that identity takes. So, like I said, that's the possibility. But here are these practical pointers for doing inquiry. Actually, I'll just skip over this first one, because it again just talks about when you are asking the question, the very formal question, "Who am I?" or "What am I?" and then something else arises, a thought, something else distracts you. There's a noise, and you just follow up with the who or what is having this experience. or who or what arrived at this answer. The obvious answer is me. I'm having this experience, or I came up with this answer. So then you return to the original question. Who or what am I? Who or what is the me? And then, of course, there's also the follow-up question of, if I am more than that, who or what am I? As the process unfolds, you can get very creative with the questions, since the questions are not the important thing. The important thing is, again, directing awareness or attention to aspects of your own experience that have not been consciously realized yet, or to ones that you've realized already, but just to bring attention to wherever that sense of I is located right now. For most people, this initially means directing attention inward to more subtle aspects of your individual experience. It's just a kind of, even the word inquiry implies that. It's an inward focus. And so there's, and for most of us, that's often something we've, you know, it overall in the course of our lives, we have often paid a lot more attention to outer levels of our experience. But as you reach the more universal dimensions of being that are also found within your individual experience, you may notice that it no longer matters what direction your inquiry is directed. It turns out it's just as rich and mysterious to inquire deeply into any object, experience, activity, or phenomenon as it is to inquire within. At that point, really any question will serve. Or you can just explore with an open curiosity, using words when it seems appropriate in the moment, and dropping all words when they are not really needed to direct attention to the mysteries all around you and everywhere within you. So this just suggests that at a certain point, inquiry, even that sense of I, can no longer be held so firmly as a focus. And in fact, the next sentence says, for example, it can be fun to strip the question down to, am I? Rather than asking who or what am I, you just simply ask, am I? And which, you know, it's like kind of questioning, do I exist? What is this, you know, so-called existence that I seem to claim when I say I am? Even if I just say I am hungry or I am a person, it's like I'm claiming this amness, I'm claiming this existence, and you can question it. You can say, is that true? Am I? Is there something here that exists? And you can even strip the question down more to am, with a question mark, which is, in essence, is asking, does anything exist? Does existence exist? Is there really such a thing? How can you be sure? These questions point to the simple fact that you are, regardless of what you are experiencing, and then it even questions that sense of existing. And existing is a dimension of kind of beneath and beyond experience. You exist even if you're not having an experience. In fact, you can. It's so tricky with words. You can exist without experience. You can exist without even awareness. The simplest example that we all experience is the experience of deep, dreamless sleep. When you wake up in the morning, there is a sense of no experience during that stretch of deep sleep. And yet, there may be something like a memory, something like just a felt sense that you existed. And that's why you can report, I slept so great last night. Because if there was no sense of existence, that would be an even emptier depth, an even experience. Or if, again, it's not an experience, it's a non-experience that's empty of all qualities of experience. Once that sense of pure existence is in your field of awareness, then it's possible possible to find out what's true about your existence, to explore that. What's it like right now to just be, to just exist? Is it enough right now to just exist? Or is there a sense that it's not enough? That simple, pure amness, existence, is there a sense that that's not enough? All our lives we've been told it's not enough. You have to be smarter, richer, prettier, more enlightened, more compassionate, more loving, and on and on. You have to be something or something more than what you are. Just existing doesn't seem to be enough. And we have the sense that if we could just be what we're supposed to be, if we could be more than what we are, then we could just be. Take a fantasy about being richer, for instance. What's great about being a whole lot richer is that you think it will finally allow you to just be. Because if you're already a lot richer, then you no longer have to become richer. It takes that, you know, it's like kind of like crossing it off your bucket list or your goals or your accomplishments, you know, like to get rich. If you're already rich, then you can just be. And so often if you strip it down, often there can be, these are like those layers or those levels of reality. Sometimes we think that if we had more money, it would allow us to experience more of our essence. Oh, I could just relax, I could be at peace, I could be more loving, I could be more creative. And then if you even take it beyond that, if you could be more loving, if you could be, you know, more present, more caring, more free, what would that allow? And it's ultimately, it allows you to just be, and for that to finally be enough, that what you are would be enough. But most of the time we think that being richer or smarter is required to finally allow just being to be enough. And this inquiry, this process of bringing your attention to being, becoming more familiar with it, it can be amazing to discover the extent to which our existence is enough, and also the extent to which we are conditioned to think it isn't enough. Either one that you discover is quite a surprising thing, to see how actually satisfying existing by itself, just that raw reality of existence is, if you know, it's kind of like jumping right to the goal. If the real goal of becoming richer or smarter or more enlightened or kinder or prettier or thinner or whatever it is to allow you to then just be, you can actually, in doing this kind of inquiry, which brings your attention to the being that's already here, you can discover that you can just go right to being. That, and you may discover that it's actually enough to just be, you know, before you get where you're supposed to be. Just be where you are. For most of us, this sense of existing is associated with the body. Existing seems to happen there. However, does your sense of existence actually stop where your body stops? Discover for yourself where your experience of I am is right now. Is it in the body, or is the body in it? In your experience right now, would it be more accurate to say I exist in the body, or to say the body exists in me? And that can start to give a sense of how that identity, that sense of existence, while it's often associated with the body, if the body is happening inside of it, if the body is happening inside your sense of I am, then it may not actually be the whole story. It comes back to that second question of, if you are more than that, what are you? If you are more than the body, what are you? At least be willing to hold the possibility that who you are goes beyond the body, even if you aren't experiencing that directly right now. The experience of the body never really goes away. Well, of course, until it does, but while you're still here as a body. But the link between the me, the link between the sense of I, the sense of existence, the sense of I am, and the body can soften or even dissolve when I am the body is seen as only part of the truth. If you experience the self, the me, outside the body, even a little, even if there's a little sense of being a little bit bigger than your body, then the body can't be the whole truth of who you are. So again, where does your sense of me stop in this moment? Right now, for instance, you can allow more of your experience of the room into awareness. When you include in your awareness the energy and information that's flowing in and out of your body in this moment, is there a greater or lesser sense of me? Once again, what is more true? To say, I exist in this room, or this room exists in me? When you include the totality of the room in your sense of self, are you more in contact with your sense of your true self or less in contact with it? Is there a greater sense of self or a smaller sense if you hold that possibility that this room, the room you're in, is inside of you? Most people find that the more they include in their experience, the larger the sense of you. And so when you ask these self-inquiry questions, when you find that they lead in all kinds of directions, you discover there's not such a clear-cut boundary to me. And Regina typed in, she said, in me. That's not obvious at first. That's a good point. But it becomes obvious through enough looking. And, you know, you don't have to, it's wonderful, you don't have to kind of shoot for the moon. You know, you can simply notice whether the sense of me includes some of the space right around your body, like the space between your legs, or the space between your arm and your torso, space between your fingers, the air moving in and out of your nose and lungs. And just notice where are the subtle boundaries that you assume are there, and then check, are they actually there? Or is that air, that space around you, actually, again, part of that sense of self? Or can they be included in your sense of self? Sometimes all you have to do is include them in your I am statement. I am the room. I am the chair I'm sitting on. I am the sounds in the room. And yet, of course, the exploration also doesn't have to stop with your body or with the space around your body or with the room that you're sitting in. In this moment, you can try sensing the reality of the surrounding city or town or countryside. Just to take in the whole neighborhood, the whole area that this room and this body, your body, is located in. And when you really kind of sense it, just sense it. You don't have to worry about the boundaries or is it me or isn't it me. But if you just sense the surrounding area, does that give you a greater or lesser sense of me? And you can ask the question, do I exist in the neighborhood, or does the neighborhood exist in me? And just notice which one, you know, there might be one that feels a little truer right now, and yet you might also be able to kind of try on the sense of me where the neighborhood exists in me. Turns out this assemblage point is very arbitrary. You can assemble it anywhere. And so you can, for a moment, just hold the sense, I am the neighborhood. I am this town. I am the entire state or country that you're in. And then there's really no limit. You can sense that I am the planet. I am the human race. I am the oneness, the pure consciousness flowing through all of it. I am in the infinity of space. So again, you can either try it on, almost like you were trying on clothes at a store to see how they fit. And they may not, you know, they may not feel quite familiar, right? Like you may not be, you may, the first time you try on, especially a whole new outfit, something that, you know, is a total different design than what you normally wear, you're not even sure if it fits, right? You don't know that kind of strange designer outfit is meant to fit that way, you know? It's kind of loose or it's kind of tight in places that you're not used to your clothes being loose or tight. And so when you try on these different answers to these questions, or when you even just ask the question, which is in a sense kind of trying it on, it may feel very unfamiliar at first. I am the neighborhood, or the neighborhood exists in me. The world exists in me. And so it might be a very unfamiliar sensation, even to ask the question, who or what am I? And if I am more than that, if I am more than the world, who or what am I? And then you just notice which one feels truer. And my definition of truth is that which softens or expands your sense of self. Whatever opens your heart and quiets your mind and gives you a more expansive, a more spacious, a more open sense of your being. And so, you know, it's kind of obvious with that definition of truth, that kind of experiential, visceral definition of truth, that if you can really try on, really step into the experience of I am the world, that's going to be a much more expanded sense of self. Now, it might trigger a reaction. It might be a bit of a stretch, just like that unfamiliar piece of clothing that you put on. Imagine trying on one of those royal wedding dresses with a 50-foot train dragging behind it. You know, at first it's like, whoa, am I supposed to take up this much room when I'm walking down the aisle of the church? It's like, oh, am I supposed to, I am the world? Wait a minute, that doesn't, you know. So it can trigger a reaction. And the reaction might not be as true as the actual experience. If you can just rest in it for a moment, I am the world. Just allow yourself to sink into that experience. And then notice what sense of self does that experience or that perspective give you. And you can start to learn to trust that visceral sense of a bigger sense of self. The flexibility, again, ultimately for me, the ideal is the flexibility to have any size of self that is functional in the moment, that's appropriate, that is called for in the moment. And in the absence of any, you know, fairly strong demands on your body or your mind, it's wonderful to discover that you can be the world. You can be infinite space. Or at least try it on. At least step into it for a moment. Now this next point is, I think, a really important one. I think I have just enough time to probably dive into it. Maybe we'll continue it next time. But as this inquiry, as this exploration of self goes deeper, a common experience is the experience of emptiness. This can be a kind of relative emptiness, where there's a relative absence of something. For example, there may be a flatness or a lack of joy or meaning You may feel a mental emptiness that seems like confusion or blankness in the mind. As you dive into this exploration, you may come up on these layers of emptiness, these levels where things seem kind of strangely lacking, empty, absent, not enough. I spoke earlier about the even existence can seem like it's not enough. And often underneath our more superficial experiences of emotions or desires, there is an inner sense of something lacking or missing. That's often what drives a lot of our emotions or desires, are these inner holes, H-O-L-E, empty spots, any empty experiences of emptiness within our being. And so if you're going to dive into your being, you're going to come across these empty holes. When we are sad or hurting, there may be an underlying sense of a lack of compassion or tenderness. Interestingly, when we are angry, there may be an underlying sense of weakness or the lack of strength. So there's like this emptiness, this hole where strength is supposed to be and it's not there, and we compensate by being very angry. Or there's an empty space where there's not a kind of tenderness, a softness, a compassion. And so we again sort of compensate by being sad. These relative experiences of emptiness or lack are often interpreted by the mind as mistakes or a sign that our inquiry is going in the wrong direction. Like when you're looking for your car keys and you open a drawer that's completely empty, and you immediately conclude that's the wrong place to look, and so you go open a different drawer or go look somewhere else for your keys. However, these inner experiences of emptiness or lack that we encounter during inquiry, or any time you encounter them, the experiences of emptiness are actually tremendous opportunities to take the inquiry deeper. The experience of emptiness or lack is often the most open doorway to the next level or layer of our being, the next deeper level. Paradoxically, the place where we feel a lack of love is often the place where deeper, truer experience of essential love will most easily be uncovered. This is it's talking specifically about love, but this is a principle, a totally surprising, almost shocking thing when you discover it, that if you can keep directing the inquiry, even when you come on a place that feels lacking or empty or not enough, that often even the thing that felt like it was missing or lacking is actually found in a much fuller, more complete way in the space itself, in the empty space itself. That's kind of a good motivator for continuing the inquiry, even when you come across an empty spot in your being. If you find something like essential love, this kind of unconditional, all-encompassing love in the place inside you that feels the most unlovable, the most lacking in love, then the next time you feel something lacking or missing, you might kind of keep going, instead of again shutting that drawer and going looking somewhere else, saying, oh, this can't be working, this isn't right, I feel, you know, there's nothing there, I must be looking in the wrong direction. You go, oh, there's nothing there, huh, I wonder what is present in that empty space. And so if you keep going in the direction of the emptiness, of the lack, there's no formula. It's not like you'll instantly discover, you know, essential love. You may find that there are layers of conditioning, layers of resistance. There may be other reactions that you have as you go towards emptiness. But ultimately, it can be a very, very rich discovery. So when your inquiry brings you to a dry, empty, lacking place with no juice or excitement, instead of turning away, that is an opportunity to sense more deeply into that experience, to find out what is present in the empty space. And that's a wonderful way of saying, to find out what is present in the empty space. I often use the metaphor that it's like walking into a totally dark room. You're going from a brightly lit room into a totally dark room. And how at first you can't see anything. Even if you held your hand up right in front of your face, you wouldn't be able to see it. But if you stand there, if you keep your eyes open, if you keep looking into that inky blackness, then after the while, in this metaphor, in this case, your physical eyes adjust. And you start to possibly be able to just make out the furniture, make out what is already present in that dark room. If there's even just a little starlight coming in through a crack in the window curtains. And so it isn't a case of having to call forth these qualities of our essence, of these more subtle aspects of our being, as much as a willingness to stand there in the dark with your eyes open, a willingness to just rest in those empty spaces and notice what you can start to sense more subtly that is already present. True essential love and peace and joy are often very spacious, very subtle, very something like starlight coming in through a crack in the window. And so it takes that subtlety of attention, that subtlety. It takes giving yourself some time for your senses, your inner senses in this case, to adjust, to start to sense what's present in those empty places within your being. And this principle of emptiness being an open doorway applies at every level of inquiry. Even when a profoundly empty experience of no self is uncovered, you can savor that pure, spacious emptiness, and yet you can also become curious as to what lies beyond even that utter blankness of no self or no experience. There's no formula. And what is present even when there is no self? What is present even when there is no one there to experience it? And so that orientation towards being willing to sense into, to stay present to not turn away from emptiness can apply at every level, even if there's just kind of a strange sense of like something lacking or something missing. Sometimes, something that drives you to go grab something out of the fridge, even though you're not hungry. There's just something you're trying to fill up something inside yourself, and at first it's kind of uncomfortable to like just be with that restlessness, with that more relative sense of emptiness, and yet it can be so rich and the reason I'm mentioning all this is that when we do this inquiry. Whenever you turn your attention to your sense of self, turn it inward, you're going to hit these. It's like you can't avoid them. They're there. And so anytime you look inward, you're going to land in some of these either very relative senses, very specific sense of something lacking, like, oh, I just feel so weak or inadequate or unworthy, a sense of lacking worthiness, lacking a sense of your own value. There can be an emptiness, a lack of clarity, a lack of understanding, a lack of strength. I mentioned that one. A lack of joy. Like, again, it's kind of dry. There's no juice, no excitement. And again, if you are doing inquiry and you land in one of these spots, even all the way up to a lack of a sense of self altogether. The invitation is to stay with the inquiry, to stay with the questioning, to even get more curious about the emptiness, about that relative spaciousness. It can be surprisingly rich what you discover if you don't turn away in the most empty spots within your being. All right, so that brings us right to the end of the hour, And there's still more. This whole thing that might be one or two more sessions, but we'll call this the practice and purpose of inquiry part two. I think that's what I called the first one. Whatever I called the first one, we can call this one the same thing, only part two. So Cheryl, if you want to double check on the list of recordings, what we call part one, let's add part, rename this, or name this recording part two. All right. So really enjoyed being here with all of you, and I'll look forward to joining with you again next Wednesday. Bye for now.